Good evening. On behalf of the World Affairs Council of Northern California, I would like to welcome you to tonight's program, The Iranian Threat and the Washington Divide. I'm Nancy Jarvis, former chair and current trustee of the World Affairs Council. We're honored to have with us this evening Joseph Cerincione, president of Plowshares Fund. It is now my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker. Joseph Cerincione joined Plowshare Funds as president in 2008. His previous positions include vice president for national security and international policy at the Center for American Progress and director for nonproliferation at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Mr. Cerincione is author of Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons, and Deadly Arsenals, Nuclear, Biological, and Chemical Threats. As well as being a frequent commentator in the media, Mr. Cerincione has appeared in the films Countdown to Zero and Why We Fight. He serves on the World Economic Forum's Global Council on Catastrophic Risks and teaches at the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. Here to discuss Iran's nuclear ambitions and Washington's response, please join me in welcoming Joseph Cerincione.
Thank you very much, and thank you, Nancy, for that kind introduction. It's true, I do have a few movie credits to my resume. I was hoping for Avatar, but Countdown to Zero, not too bad. I'd like to take the next 25 minutes or so to talk about four aspects of the Iranian situation. First, what is the problem? What are we talking about? Why is this an issue at all? Second is to talk about why we haven't found a solution to it. What have been the attempts and what has thwarted solutions in the past? Then take a look at the prospects for finding a solution to this anytime soon. And finally, what are the politics around this? How is this issue going to play out over the next couple of years as we enter the presidential campaign? First, the problem itself. The problem is not that Iran has a nuclear reactor. The nuclear reactor at Bushehr, which is expected to go online in the next couple of months, has been a project of Iran prior to the Islamic Republic. The Shah of Iran started the reactor program. It will be the only operational power reactor in the Middle East, and in fact, outside of South Africa, the only one in Africa, in the African Middle East region. The problem is the fuel facilities that Iran is building to make fuel, it says, for the reactor. It is building a uranium enrichment facility that would take uranium from the Iranian mines, process it, enrich it, make it into fuel rods, insert it into the reactor, take the fuel rods out of the reactor when they reach the end of their operational life, break it down in a reprocessing facility that will allow it to reclaim some of the plutonium that comes out of those fuel rods. The problem is that these civilian facilities have decidedly military potential. The enrichment plant at Natanz that can enrich uranium to low levels for fuel can also enrich it to high levels for weapons. Low levels, 3 to 5%, which is what you need for fuel, can be those same centrifuges, the same facility, can be configured and ramped up to enrich it to 90% pure uranium, which is what you need for a bomb. The same reprocessing facility that they're building that can take the spent fuel rods and reprocess them for waste disposal and possible reclaiming of some of the elements can also be used to take that plutonium and use it for a nuclear weapon. It is the dual nature of these fuel facilities that give people concern. Almost every country that has such facilities also has nuclear weapons. The two exceptions to this are Japan, which has both of them, and right now Brazil, which is starting an enrichment facility. The reason that people are worried about this is not the nature of the Iranian regime. It's not that they're a Muslim country. It's not that they're at odds with some of the U.S. allies in the region. It's the way this uranium enrichment program was begun, secretly, covertly, in violation of Iran's treaty obligations under the Non-Proliferation Treaty. So while parts of the program, for example, the construction of the reactor, were happening openly, other parts of the program, in particular, the acquisition of centrifuges from the AQ Khan network in Pakistan, the procurement of certain high-tech devices and certain nuclear materials from other countries was done secretly, starting during the Iran-Iraq War in the 1980s and proceeding with fits and starts all the way up to 2003, when they were disclosed by an Iranian dissident group. And it was the first time that the outside world knew that Iran was building a secret centrifuge facility underground at the city of Natanz. And then all the other elements of the program came to light. And it's also some of the nature of these programs, their involvement of the military in parts of these programs, the certain experiments that were conducted on things that have nothing to do with civilian use of nuclear technology, and the way Iran is configured the program that leads many people to believe that Iran's purpose in developing these facilities is not for fuel, but for weapons. Iran now is at loggerheads, not just with the United States, but with the United Nations. It's the United Nations that has passed resolutions finding Iran in violation of its safeguard agreements, the right of inspectors to go to these facilities. It is the United Nations that has found that Iran has not satisfactorily answered questions on the history of its program. And it is the United Nations that has imposed the most severe sanctions that have ever been imposed on any country. And they did that just last year. Fine. So that's the problem. The rest of the world, with the United Nations, wants Iran to come clean on this program, wants them to suspend the enrichment capability until the world can have confidence that Iran's purpose in these programs is truly peaceful. Iran wants nothing to do with that. They don't trust the rest of the world. They particularly don't trust the United States. And they are insisting that they have a right to this technology and that they should be allowed to proceed with it, and we should just back off. One of the reasons Iranian authorities recently offered to have international officials tour its nuclear facilities, and I have been on such a tour in 2005, I think is in part to impress these authorities, these diplomats, with the scale of the Iranian effort, with the permanence of the Iranian effort, to say to the rest of the world, we're real, we're here, get used to it. That's the situation we have. That's the current problem. Solutions to the problem. We've come close to solving this problem several times in the past, and the history is basically characterized by unfortunate timing. When one side has been willing to talk and negotiate a solution, the other side has been unwilling to talk. For example, right after the U.S. Invasion of Afghanistan, after 9/11, we had close cooperation with Iran on those operations. In fact, many experts believe the reason we were able to achieve such a quick victory was because of the Iranian cooperation that we had. There was weekly, even daily contact between U.S. officials and Iranian officials on that. Iranian officials, we now know, expected that this cooperation in Afghanistan was going to lead to a breakthrough in the relationship between Iran and the United States. Didn't happen. Instead, they've heard the President of the United States in his State of the Union address denounce Iran as part of the axis of evil. They saw the United States invade Iraq. At that point, the Iranian authorities were very concerned that they would be next. They had not yet started the centrifuge program in earnest. There were no centrifuges spinning. There was no uranium being enriched. Iran faxed a proposal to the United States to have talks, not just on the nuclear program, but on Iran's relationship with Israel, on Iran's relationship with Hezbollah and Hamas, the opposition groups that plague Israel. The whole thing was on the table, but the U.S. wasn't interested in having those talks. The talk in Washington at those time was about regime change, that men go to Baghdad, real men go to Tehran. The view was that we were going to roll the table, that we're going to be able, through the use of military force, to force regime change on a series of uncooperative governments in the region, and that Tehran was high on the list. As we know, that plan backfired. Regime change, we invaded in Iraq, the one country that didn't have nuclear weapons, and the country that was secretly pursuing a program accelerated the program. Iran made more progress on their nuclear program in the last 5 years than they had in the previous 15. Most of the concern we now have is from the activities that have taken place since we chose not to negotiate with them, since we thought we could force or compel either a change in regime or a change in the program. The new president of the United States is elected in Washington, and in his inaugural address, he issues an offer to Iran to talk, extends the hands of friendship to Iran. It's Iran who doesn't want to talk. Ayatollah Khamenei is in no mood to talk with the United States, doesn't trust us, doesn't think a change in presidency means there's a change in policy, is convinced that the U.S. is still intent on regime change and holds that view to this day. So despite the best efforts of the United States to reach out and negotiate, it's Iran that's been rejecting that for the last 2 years. We're at loggerheads. And that's why you've heard so much talk over the last few years about military strikes. About the solution to this problem is to strike Iran. Forget the talks. Let's just go knock out the facilities. And it's led to deep concern over various points that we were close to war with Iran. Those concerns have abated. Here we are in the current situation. The current situation actually gives room for some optimism on several fronts. One, experts and governments are now a little more relaxed about the pace of the Iranian program. They're not worried that Iran is about to get the bomb, that it's only a matter of months. And for those of you who have been listening to these warnings for the last 10 years that Iran is 1 to 2 years away from a nuclear weapon, the consensus view now is that it's more like 1 to 5 years. And one of the most important statements in this regard has come from military and intelligence officials in Israel, who have readjusted their views of the Iranian program, including the former head of Mossad, the intelligence service, and other officials who have just in the last few weeks say they now believe that Iran won't get a bomb until 2015 or so. And this is now in conformity with the U.S. estimate. And it's no coincidence these views coincide. There's been a lot more cooperation between the U.S. And Israeli intelligence services in developing this. And one of the reasons that estimate is now stretched out is because the sanctions program is working. The sanctions program that this current administration implemented has been very successful in constraining Iran's ability to get critical materials that it needs to construct more centrifuges, very high-tech materials like carbon fire and meringuing steel that it needs for key components of the centrifuges, it can't get. So it may be near the limits of how much they can expand the centrifuge program. And the other reason is that with the story you've heard in the press a lot is the computer virus that has infected machinery that's particular to the centrifuge program. The Stuxnet virus is a virus that unknowns to the operators, speeds up and then slows down the centrifuges. You do that a few times and you wreck the centrifuge. So we know that Iran has now dismantled about 1,000 centrifuges from its 8,000 or so that it's installed. That the centrifuge program is much farther behind schedule than people thought it was going to be. There are actually fewer centrifuges enriching uranium in Iran now than there were a year ago. That's not where that program was supposed to be. So the combination of these sanctions and this sabotage, presumably by some national group, we don't really know if it's the U.S. or Israel or even Russia or China. We don't know who's done this, but the evidence is pretty clear that something has happened there, and that has relaxed people's view of how much time we have. So, we now have time, here's the prospects, we now have time to work on a diplomatic solution to this. And because the sanctions are biting so hard, there's actually some increased incentive inside the Iranian leadership to seek a negotiated solution. And that's part of the reason that you saw Iran agree to their first, to the new talks with the U.S. and the other members of the UN Security Council plus Germany, a group you call the P5 plus one, the five permanent members of the UN Security Council plus Germany. This is the group that's been negotiating with Iran and trying to find a diplomatic solution to the program. They met a couple of months ago. They're about to meet again near the end of January, January 21st and 22nd in Istanbul. Success for these 2 days of talks would be agreement to talk again. That's the standard of success. We're just trying to see if we can get this negotiating process going. Both sides are making statements to the press, and I would interpret all those statements as being basically negotiating positions, trying to set up the expectations for these talks. Inside Washington, there's increased talk about a new deal that the U.S. might offer. It wouldn't solve the problem, but the goal right now in the near future is to find a sort of a confidence-building measure. Can we solve part of the problem? And that would be defined, for example, in finding a solution to Iran's desire to get new fuel for another reactor, the research reactor that the U.S. sold the Shah of Iran back in the 1970s. The research reactor needs a new fuel supply. This is a more highly enriched uranium. It's a 20% uranium mix. Iran is now enriching some of its uranium to that level, increasing concerns that material gets just another step closer to a nuclear weapon. Can you find some solution where the West or Russia could supply that fuel in exchange? Iran would agree to ship out of the country its stockpile of low-enriched uranium that it has. You do that, and you're buying more time. So you take the uranium that Iran has already enriched, you take it out, and in exchange, you give them enriched uranium for the fuel rods. It's a small step, but it'd be that kind of confidence-building measure that people have been talking about for the last couple of years. You might see new proposals on that. Fine. Most people think this. If this is going to go any place at all, this is going to take at least a year or more of negotiations. Is there a diplomatic path to solve this problem? Well, this is where you get the divide, and this is where the politics start to come in. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said yesterday that Iran would curb its nuclear activities in response only to a threat of attack. So this is one camp, that the only way to get Iran to negotiate an agreement to end the program is to threaten it with attack. You have to ratchet up the pressure, he said. I don't think that this pressure will be sufficient. The current pressure, the sanctions, will be sufficient to have this regime change course without a credible military option. So that's one view. More force is necessary, more coercive. Ironically, the counter view comes also from Israel. Lieutenant General Gabi Ashkenazi has just left as head of the Israeli Armed Forces, in part because he had a falling out with Israel's leadership over statements like this. Initiating a war with Iran will only bring disaster upon Israel. And that's his view. So threatening to go to war in this view, makes it more difficult to reach a diplomatic solution, hardens Iran's stance, and if you actually go to war, it's a disaster for Israel, it's a disaster for the region. This is generally the view of the U.S. military. The U.S. military does not want a third war in the Middle East, or four if you count the war in Pakistan as separate. The general consensus among military and strategic experts is that a military strike in Iran would guarantee that Iran would get a nuclear weapon. You might be able to set back the program by a few months, a year and a half, is Secretary of Defense Robert Gates' estimate, but it would end the debate inside Iran about whether or not there would be a bomb. It would be pedal to the metal. It would be get a bomb at all costs as quick as you can. So a military strike is counterproductive. And thus, the only way, in this view, is to seek a diplomatic solution. And the way to seek a diplomatic solution is not more sticks, but actually to put some credible carrots on the table. And you see recommendations like this coming out of Washington now from groups like the Henry L. Stimson Center and the U.S. Institute of Peace, who just published an excellent new study on Iran, saying that this has been the problem. The U.S. has not laid out a credible path for Iran to take. What are the benefits of cooperation? How do you convince the leaders of Iran that there really is a willingness on the United States to cooperate and not to seek regime change? And what would that look like? And so there's now an increasing effort among experts, and particularly those who are close to the U.S. administration, advising on what the blueprint would look like. This debate will now reverberate in the political sphere in the United States. In about 6 months, in the new House of Representatives, you have a new leadership of the House Foreign Affairs Committee that is much more in the Netanyahu view, that sees that really the only solution is going to be a military strike in Iran, and their game plan is to sort of lay the groundwork from that. And you see this reflected in many of the neoconservative journals and press, like the Weekly Standard or the Wall Street Journal or the Heritage Foundation. The same people who argued for war with Iraq are now arguing for war with Iran. And they're basically following the same game plan. In my estimate, we're approximately in 1998. In 1998, you had a group of a small group advocating military strikes on Iraq with a Democratic president, not because they thought that president was actually going to go to war with Iraq, but they were laying the groundwork for when they got a more cooperative, more sympathetic administration. I think that's the game plan they're now following for Iran. In other words, there is a group in Washington that wants war with Iran. The Weekly Standard says it. They run editorials that this is what we have to do. This is the only way we're going to solve our problem. And they are now laying the groundwork, and you'll see that in hearings in the House of Representatives. You'll hear more talk about this. And then this will become go on to a very high level when the Republican presidential primaries begin in earnest, because the Republican candidates for president are going to be playing to the base of the party, and the base of the party, they believe, it wants a strong military response, wants to have a candidate who's going to promise to put an end to the Iranian threat, and you will hear an escalating amount of rhetoric on the need for military strikes on Iran. I believe this will play out at least at the beginning of the presidential campaign in 2012, and the risk of a military conflict with Iran will be low during 2011 and start increasing 2012 and might actually get quite serious in 2013, in part because if the sanctions don't work, if we stay with just the sanctions-heavy approach, that eventually will run its course. The Iranian program has been slowed but not stopped. So if the sanction approach doesn't work, it's going to be felt that the war option is going to be back on the table. So those of us who believe that there is a diplomatic solution, it's up to us to come up with the path for that diplomatic solution, to promote that diplomatic solution, to both contain the Iranian program and engage Iran in a way that can lead to at first small confidence building measures, and then the possibility of a comprehensive deal that would at least suspend Iran's enrichment program, increase the inspection authority on Iran, start to resolve the underlying conflict that exists between the U.S. and Iran, and by the way, take care of Israeli security concerns about Iran's military capability and Iran's security concerns about U.S. military intentions. That's the path that lies before us over the next year. At Plowshares Fund, we are committed to promoting a diplomatic solution to end the Iranian threat. We understand the politics around this will make this difficult, but I believe that we enjoy currently the consensus of both America's security experts in both Republicans and Democratic parties, and to both Republican and Democratic security experts outside the parties, and the U.S. military. The U.S. military is eager to find a diplomatic solution to this that doesn't exacerbate the tough military situation we already face in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. Thank you very much. I'll be happy to talk and take your questions.
Thank you very much. We'll now take questions from the audience. As the main international and U.S. effort at the moment seems to be concentrated on trade sanctions, why don't we speak about trade sanctions for a few moments? There are a lot of questions on it. To start out, though, to define the personalities, Robert Einhorn is the U.S. State Department official coordinating sanctions against Iran and North Korea. Joseph Cerincione has called him the Thomas Jefferson of arms control. Perhaps you could explain that to us.
Bob Einhorn is one of the most scholarly and knowledgeable people in the field. He was an assistant secretary of state in charge of nonproliferation for years under both Republican and Democratic administrations. He's a very erudite writer on this subject and has just this keen, fine, deep knowledge of the field and the sort of frameworks for how one addresses these problems. He's now a senior advisor to the Secretary of State, and he is heading up the Iran effort. You don't hear about him much. He doesn't give a lot of speeches. I'm going to a luncheon with him in a couple of weeks. But he's the one who's coordinating both the sanctions approach and the possibility of a diplomatic approach to Iran. You should feel good about this, that you have at the head, one of the chief coordinators for the policy, someone who deeply believes in diplomacy as a means of solving these tough problems, but who doesn't shrink from coercive measures such as sanctions, and understands that sanctions alone have never coerced a country into compliance or collapse under any circumstances. They're just part of the operation. They're part of the tool. He's exquisitely been applying that pressure, steadily increasing it. I expect the United States to put more sanctions on targeted at particular financial institutions in Iran and countries that are supplying, that are involved in the supply of the Iran nuclear program, and at the Revolutionary Guard leadership, the radical group that controls increasingly much of the Iranian apparatus, but at the same time to be open to developing these diplomatic alternatives. That's the kind of leadership that I think Thomas Jefferson displayed, and it's one of the reasons I put him in that same category.
Do other nations such as Russia and China see a diplomatic solution as a viable option as well? I understand that Russia and China had carve-outs from the sanctions that are imposed.
Yeah. Russia and China, and in fact, most of the world, see a diplomatic solution as the only solution for this. And this has been a delicate game for the United States to play, because in order to get UN sanctions, you have to have the five permanent members of the UN Security Council in agreement. So the United States, United Kingdom, France, pretty easy. We can get that. Russia, China, tougher. Particularly because some people in those two countries believe that the United States is only playing a game, that the U.S. has no intention of negotiating an agreement. And they understood what happened in the Iraq War, where once again the United States, in that situation, the United States came and said, we don't want to go to war. We're not going to strike. All we want is sanctions. All we want UN resolutions. And they saw those UN resolutions later used by a president of the United States to initiate an attack on Iraq under the claim that there was an imminent nuclear danger. So they don't want to be played for suckers. So there's hesitation on both those countries. Nonetheless, the behavior of the Iranian regime has been outrageous. And the balance was tipped with the disclosure in September of 2009 of a secret centrifuge facility at the city of Qom. So not only was there still outstanding questions about what Iran had been doing in the 1990s and early 2000s, now under their very noses, embarrassing China and Russia, the Iranians were doing it again. building a secret facility that they should have declared and they didn't declare. Well, that tipped the balance for Iran, for Russia and China, and they went along with the sanctions resolution. But they've been upset at what happened later, which is the European Union piled on its own sanctions, the United States piled on its own sanctions, Japan and Korea piled on their own sanctions, and China and Russia are a little concerned about this. Finally, one last thing. If you want to solve the Iran problem, you need Russia. You can't solve this problem without Russia. Russia's key to the solution. And that's why the recently negotiated and now approved by the U.S. Senate New START agreement that's about U.S.-Russian nuclear arms that provides a new framework for reducing those arms and new inspections for ensuring that those reductions take place and that forges a new political relationship between the U.S. and Russia is so important to solving the Iran problem. And why you saw so many Jewish groups, American Jewish groups, come out and actively lobby in support of the New START agreement. They understand the connection. You want a close U.S.-Russian partnership in order to stop Iran, and a demonstrated proof of that partnership is Russia's decision last year to cancel the sale of S-300 anti-aircraft missiles, a very capable system equivalent to the U.S. Patriot system that's used for air defense. It's a $13 billion deal, so we're talking real money that Iran was going to buy from Russia. Russia canceled the sale as part of its agreement to sanction Iran. That's the kind of tangible benefit the U.S.-Russian partnership gives you in solving the Iran problem.
You mentioned the START Treaty. There is a question about whether there is any relationship between Congress having passed the START Treaty and the current talks in Istanbul.
Absolutely. I just alluded to it. And it's not, as some critics sometimes say, that it's some naive hope that if the U.S. reduces its nuclear arsenal, somehow, you know, Iran and North Korea will follow suit. No, that's not the equation at all. We want to lead by example, but it's not that kind of naive example. You need to have the United States and Russia show that they are serious about reducing their nuclear weapons and have control over their nuclear weapons and transparency over their nuclear weapons if you're going to have any hope of getting the international cooperation you need to apply the pressure on Iran and North Korea. Because in order, as I gave one example of how you need Russian help to do this, you need the help of lots of countries to end the Iranian program. Countries that actually have a very different view of the world than we do. Countries like one I just visited, Dubai, or countries like Malaysia, countries like Pakistan. Iran's nuclear program began in Pakistan with an AQCON network that sold the designs and contracted with a factory in Malaysia to make the centrifuges that were transshipped through Dubai and ended up in Iran. So if you're going to stop Iran from getting the materials it needs to accelerate its program, you have to convince Dubai to have greater inspections on its transshipment. That costs a lot of money. There's a lot of stuff going through Dubai that people don't want inspected. You got to convince Malaysia to have export controls. This is a new concept for a country that's export dependent. Why would you want to control exports? You got to get control over Pakistan to have them rein in AQ Khan, the hero of Pakistan, who's the father of the Pakistani nuclear bomb, who has a secret network that's importing material into Pakistan for Pakistan's program. So you got to get the cooperation of all those countries. You don't have a prayer of getting that cooperation if you're going around saying that nuclear weapons are essential to U.S. national security. We're going to build more of that. We don't want to have agreements with other countries. That just fractures the whole framework you're trying to promote. So that is really the connection. The U.S.-Russian agreements to reduce their weapons are the glue that holds the whole nonproliferation regime together. There's nothing naive about that.
Do international sanctions against Iran have a harsh effect on the Iranian middle class?
Yes. Yes. It's tough in Tehran now. Things cost more. The Iranian regime is grossly incompetent in its management of the natural resources of Iran. They are an oil-rich, natural gas-rich country, and under their leadership, even before these sanctions, they've allowed the investment in their oil development infrastructure, a gas infrastructure, to deteriorate. It's at its lowest point in decades right now, and the sanctions have made it harder for them not just to get parts and spare parts, but to get the investment they critically need. Investment is drying up inside Iran. Companies are making economic decisions that this is a poor risk, a poor place to invest. And it ripples out in things like, I'll give you one concrete example, air travel. Because of the sanctions, most European airports no longer sell aviation fuel to Iranian air jets. So just so you understand this, if you've been to the United Kingdom or to France or to Germany, you can walk down the street and you see Iranian Air shops open where you can buy a ticket on Iranian Air, because those countries have diplomatic relations with Iran. It's not like the United States. You have diplomatic relations, you can go to Iran, but the sanctions now said that even though an Iranian air jet can land in Paris, it can't buy fuel in Paris. So this makes it much more difficult for the 30,000 or so Iranians who travel to Europe every year to get there. The cost goes up. The number of stops they have to make to get there increases. So it's difficult just in that regard. It's not the same as the impact the Iraq sanctions had, where you actually were talking about medicines being in short supply in Iraq. It's not like that, but it's definitely a cost. And of course, that's the point of sanctions. The whole point is to increase the economic pressure on a government to make it willing to forge a deal that can alleviate that the cost and inconvenience to its own citizens. And you're seeing some of that happen now, not in the form of like mass protests, but in the concern of the bazaari, the merchant class of Iran, that are losing money because of these sanctions.
What about the Saudis? Aren't they very motivated to keep nuclear weapons out of Iran?
I was just in Dubai for a conference of the World Economic Forum, and I was there the week that you had the WikiLeaks disclosure, and this was confidential cables, State Department cables released, that quoted the comments of some of the leaders of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, where I was. Dubai is in the United Arab Emirates. And it had some of these leaders urging the United States to take military strikes on Iran. One leader was quoted as saying, "You have to cut off the head of the snake." And this kind of talk is no news to people who have been to the region or have talked to people in the region, because you've known that the Muslim Arab rivals of this Muslim Persian state see Iran as not just a challenge but a threat to them. There's the Sunni Shia divide that falls into this as well, and over the years, several of the leaders of these countries have even offered military assets to the United States to make a strike. This is not a view that's supported by the population of these countries. The population of these countries tends to be very pro-Iranian. They see this as the enemy of our friend is our friend, and they've been attracted by the anti-Israel rhetoric of particularly President Ahmadinejad over the years, which is why Ahmadinejad says these things. He understands where the Arab leadership is at, and he's trying to undercut the Arab leadership, trying to prevent an anti-Iranian coalition by appealing to the Arab street. That strategy has actually been very, very successful. There's a lot more to say about that, but let me leave it there.
You mentioned WikiLeaks. Among the items disclosed were U.S. efforts to gather information on Iran via so-called Iran Watch stations in the nations surrounding Iran. And it also revealed a growing instability in Iran's largely Sunni southeastern province, as well as increased heroin shipments to Iran through Azerbaijan. Will these disclosures set back American intelligence efforts?
That's a good question. There are so many U.S. intelligence resources devoted to Iran right now. I don't think so. And there is such an interest in the neighboring, on the part of the neighboring states to increase the intelligence on Iran. And there's so much discontent inside Iran that leads to the kind of dissent and information flows and defections that I think we're going to get more and more intelligence on Iran, not less and less. And you've seen some of that with some of the defects of nuclear scientists and even military officers, embassy officials over this. And that's been exacerbated by the deeply flawed June 2009 elections, where many people feel Ahmadinejad was declared the winner fraudulently. So I think we're going to see probably an increase on that. But, you know, Jim, you mentioned the drugs. I'm just going to take an opportunity to talk about the drug situation. Iran is a very large and very complicated country, and it's a country with a lot of problems. There are a million heroin addicts in Tehran. A million heroin addicts in Tehran because of Afghanistan, because of the easy and cheap supply of this drug. There is a war that goes on the Afghan-Iran border where Iranian military personnel die almost every day with the drug smugglers. There is a natural alliance waiting for us there between the U.S. and Iran on solving the Afghanistan problem. It was very real in 2001, in the beginning of 2002. It's the kind of sort of common cause, common interest that should be further developed, should be exploited as one of the ways to solve this problem. In other words, it isn't necessarily true that the way to solve the nuclear crisis is to keep going directly at the nuclear crisis. You may be able, if anybody plays chess, there's a flanking maneuver over here, that you may be able to gain some ground in an issue where you have much more natural agreement than the one where you have the most disagreement. The Afghan supply of heroin to Iran could be one such issue.
What is the cause of scarcity of the metals Iran cannot get? Are they country-specific?
You're at the limit of my expertise. I need to call on Dave. Can I use a lifeline? I need to call David Albright at the Institute for Science and International Security, who is a Plowshares grantee and one of the smartest people on this issue, and could pick out right away which are the countries that are supplying carbon fiber and miraging steel. There's a handful of countries that make this, and what's happened is the export controls make it much more difficult. I wouldn't say impossible, but much more difficult for Iran to get these kinds of critical components, as well as, it's sort of very high technical equipment that it needs to calibrate the centrifuges, the computers to run the centrifuges. You start tightening that up, and then something like a sabotage is much more effective because it takes much longer to recover from the effects of the sabotage than it otherwise would.
I'm going to move backward a bit to some very basic questions. We have about a half a dozen questions on a very basic issue. What are the repercussions of Iran getting a nuclear weapon? Given that Israel already has nuclear weapons, do you think Iran's nuclear weapons would balance out the region?
No.
Obviously this is a common concern. We had a very
lightning
basic
round.
Does Iran or any country in a hostile neighborhood have the right to their own doesn't Iran or any country in a hostile neighborhood have the right to their own weapons? What are Iran's motives for wanting to have a full cycle nuclear program?
Okay. Does every country have the right to a nuclear weapons? Not if you've signed a treaty that says you won't acquire those nuclear weapons. Israel, India, and Pakistan never signed that treaty. Was it right for them to get nuclear weapons? I don't think so. But it wasn't illegal. They never said they weren't going to do it. Iran has said, like 187 other countries, we are not going to acquire nuclear weapons. We promised. And in exchange for that promise, you, the countries that have nuclear technology for civil purposes, promised to sell us that civil technology for our energy purposes or our medical purposes. And we also agree that there'll be a system of inspections that will guard that technology so you can be assured, you people who sold it to us, that we're not using it for military purposes. That's the deal. That's the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty that was negotiated by Republicans and Democrats in the 1960s that has made the world a safer place. There are far fewer countries pursuing nuclear programs now than there were then. More countries have given up nuclear weapons and nuclear programs over the last 25 years and have tried to acquire them because of that treaty and the regime it built. And here comes Iran, signs the treaty, promises it's going to do something, undertakes obligation, and cheats. And cheats. And secretly acquires these technologies for almost definitely weapons purposes. So that's the problem. You gotta hold people accountable. Speed limits don't work if you don't arrest people for speeding. So that's the issue that you have with Iran. So no, it does not have, it has a right to nuclear technology for peaceful purposes. It does not have a right to nuclear technology for weapons purposes. What's its motive? Is there an economic motive to actually develop nuclear power plants? Lots of countries, there are 40 countries that have nuclear power plants. Personally, I think this is an uneconomical, dangerous technology that is not the way to solve global warming, that is not the way to supply the electrical needs of your country. But countries don't necessarily operate according to rational policy. So if Finland wants to build a nuclear plant, which it is, China wants to build them, India wants to build them, Iran wants to build them, go right ahead. You do have a right to that. If you're asking why does a country want nuclear weapons, the answer is very clear. Security, prestige, domestic politics. Those are the three basic factors behind every country's decision to have nuclear weapons. If Iran gets a nuclear weapon, will it balance out the equation? No. It will make a bad situation worse. It will make that region more unstable, and this, I believe, is one of the reasons Iran will not acquire nuclear weapons. Not because the United States forces them not to, not because Israel threatens to attack them if they do, but it's in their own national security interest not to get that weapon. Because once they get that weapon, the other guys have a move too. You can't make the fallacy of the last move, thinking that you get the last move and therefore you win the game. No, the game continues. What does Saudi Arabia do? What does Egypt do? What does Turkey do? I tell you, in D.C., we always joke that there is a crate with a Pakistani nuclear bomb sitting at the tarmac with a Saudi Arabia label on it, ready to ship should Iran get a bomb. Turkey has just started its own civilian nuclear power program. Hasn't felt the need to do one of these in the 65 years of the nuclear age. Suddenly, it's beginning its own nuclear power program. Egypt has talked about a civilian nuclear power program. What could happen is what experts always worry about, a cascade of proliferation. A cascade of proliferation. It's not Israel-Iran. It's Iran, Egypt, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, others. So if the worst happens and everything fails and you've got to now be working on a containment regime that can prevent that cascade from happening. And I think you could build such a containment regime because deterrence is alive and well. Even if Iran gets a nuclear weapon, it is highly unlikely that they would use it. No country has since 1945 because they know what would happen next. If a country uses a nuclear weapon, again, it's not the last move. You get a move too. And in this case, there'd be a number of Iran's foes, adversaries, who would have nuclear options to retaliate if Iran should ever use it. So you got to be working, number one, on preventing a military strike on Iran. Make sure that we don't make this situation worse. Number two, finding the diplomatic solution to it. And number three, building the basis for a containment regime should your diplomatic options fail.
There is another group of very basic questions about the positive and negative effects of bombing Iran's nuclear facilities. You mentioned that briefly. is it in any possible military strike to take out nuclear sites in Iran? How can anyone assure the accuracy of where key resources exist in any selected site? If you could, the bombing option is slightly off the table at the moment, as you mentioned, but if you could explore that a little bit further.
Right. I would say it's been moved to the edge of the table. You know, it's still there. So I believe that several countries have operational plans drawn up for bombing Iran. The U.S. military has operational plans drawn up for bombing Iran. Our military leaders have gone over these plans in great detail, which is why they don't want to do it. Because when you start to look at this problem, it gets very scary and very unsatisfactory. It's easy to beat your chest and talk about being tough on Iran, like Senator Lindsey Graham did a couple of months ago. Right after the election, he talked about not just bombing Iran's nuclear facilities, but going after their military capabilities, their ports, their air bases. He said, "We got to neuter Iran." That was the phrase he used. That is so naive. That is so simplistic. It isn't that we couldn't try to do it. We have a huge military capability in this country. The plans that have been discussed about bombing Iran talk about two basic options, there's a range of them, but two basic options is a 5-day, 1,500-site option, the number of sorties that you would give. There's a 10-day option with about 3,000 sorties, and you'd have to go after these sites. One of the questions said, well, how would you know where they are? Good point. Doesn't make any difference how precisely guided your munition is if you don't know where to aim it. And this is one of the key military concerns. Would we hit everything? The second military concern is the hardness of the target. If you hit it, are you really knocking it out? Many of these targets are buried. The Natanz facility is 80 feet deep under reinforced concrete. Could you set back the program? Yes, but this is where Secretary Gates' wisdom comes in. Secretary Gates says we're talking about a year, maybe 18 months, and then they rebuild. And then they rebuild, and then they go all out for the bomb. So you're only talking about a delay, and the reason is airstrikes have never knocked out another country's military capabilities. The only way to ensure that Iran's nuclear capabilities are eliminated is to have troops on the ground standing on the site. And that's a military invasion of Iran, not a military strike. And that's when, if you're serious about this, if you really look at the military equation, you realize that that is not a solution. That is a disaster. That is a disaster. And once you start to realize this, you realize you got to take that military operation, that military option, and really just take it off the table, because it isn't a real option. And that talking about it doesn't help you. It makes matters worse. It makes matters worse.
We have several comments about today's news on Lebanon. Now that Hezbollah has collapsed the Lebanese government, how central is the tension along the Israeli border to the U.S. conflict with Iran? Will you comment on today's actions of Hezbollah and other opponents in Lebanon? What role does Iran play in these actions?
Again, you're at the limits of my expertise. I don't know that. I don't know enough to comment authoritarily about what's happened. In general, however, there's no question that Iran has been funding Hezbollah to serve as a pressure point on Israel. And Iran has an agenda that's different from Hezbollah's, that might be using Hezbollah in certain capacities. That if, for example, there was a military strike on Iran, most experts believe that you would see Iran using Hezbollah to strike at Israel, maybe trying to use Hamas as well to strike at Israel. This is a real good example of unintended consequences. You know, two Israeli invasions of Lebanon led first to the creation of Hezbollah as it first moved in, and then in the recent Lebanese war, an attempt to militarily defeat Hezbollah actually increased its political influence, although Hezbollah did suffer serious military setbacks, and you're seeing some of the result of that today. And it just, for me, it underscores my point that the military solution is often an illusion, that there, you can't solve these kinds of conflicts by military force, even when you have such an outrageous imbalance of power as you put in the Israeli army against Hezbollah. On paper, there's no contest here. In reality, even a small ragtag, semi-equipped military force can often stymie the strategic goals of a much more capable, much more heavily armed military force. It should be a lesson to us all about the danger of pursuing these seemingly quick military fixes.
Please comment on Israel's nuclear capability. What is its effect on the greater Middle East?
So Israel's had nuclear weapons since about 1968. It sought them for the main reason that most countries do, it's security. You can understand the reason for doing that. It turns out it has not really helped Israel's security. It has not prevented Israel from being attacked, as they were in the 1970s. It has done nothing for the main source of Israel's security, which is the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which goes on completely independent of nuclear weapons. And it is no longer in Israel's security interest, I believe, to maintain nuclear weapons, since they have a conventional military power that can defeat any regional rival or combination of rivals. It has not created an arms race in the Middle East. Common mistake that people make, thinking that Israel's acquisition of a nuclear bomb has triggered an arms race or has caused Iran to get a nuclear weapon. No. There's been little tremors of it. You might say that Egypt's interest in chemical weapons was triggered, or Syria's interest in chemical weapons was triggered by Israel's nuclear program. But no one seriously pursued a nuclear program in response to Israel. Iran's nuclear program was in response to Iraq. It was when Iraq invaded Iran that they began to, under the Islamic Republic, and nobody did anything about it. Nobody came to Iran's aid. The U.S. vetoed a security resolution at the U.N. Security Council condemning Iraq's use of chemical weapons against Iranian forces. That's when Iran restarted the nuclear program that the Shah had begun. I would say Israel's nuclear program at this point was not a source of regional stability, but does not serve Israel's nuclear security interest, national security interest at this point, and that we're getting very close to the time when it makes sense for Israel to take its bombs out of the basement and put them on the negotiating table, because Israel's fundamental security interest is in making sure that no regional adversary has the one weapon that can threaten Israel. And the way to get that is to make sure that nobody in the region has those weapons. You have to get serious about a Middle East free of nuclear weapons.
Perhaps some of you were in the audience when George Shultz introduced the nuclear tipping point, the film that was made under the guise of the effort headed by George Shultz, Sam Nunn, Bill Perry, and Henry Kissinger. As a final question, how has their effort altered how nuclear nonproliferation is viewed politically?
Yeah. There has really been a tremendous change over the last few years on the view of nuclear weapons in U.S. and global security. Just to be clear about this, since the height of the Cold War, we have made tremendous progress in reducing the numbers of nuclear weapons, reducing the number of states that have nuclear weapons. We have cut global arsenals by two-thirds. So there are tens of thousands of fewer nuclear weapons in the world than there were. Most countries that were pursuing or were interested in these programs in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s have given them up. We still have 20,000 nuclear weapons, however. We still have 9 countries with nuclear weapons. And there is now, as a result of this kind of bipartisan or nonpartisan call that's come out from Democrats and Republicans, a new bipartisan consensus that nuclear weapons are not part of the security solution, they're the security problem. that it's in the U.S. national security interest to get rid of nuclear weapons, not to keep them. There's debate about this, there is contention about this, but you increasingly see that view, particularly among experts who are not actively involved in either of the two political parties. You see that view in the U.S. military. The U.S. military cares less and less about nuclear weapons. These are increasingly a problem for the U.S. military, maintaining them, safeguarding them. That's a huge budgetary cost. We spend $54 billion a year on nuclear weapons in a time when the defense budget is slowing down, and we may be seeing over the next 10 years real decreases in U.S. defense budget spending, defense budget. Is that really where you want to put your money? Do you really want to have a new nuclear bomber, a new nuclear sub, or do you want to put it where the serious security needs of the country really are? You've seen the Nuclear Posture Review of the United States, heavily influenced by the kinds of things that Bill Perry and George Shultz and Sam Nunn and Henry Kissinger have said, reduced roles for nuclear weapons, reduced reliance, and for the first time in U.S. history, a commitment enshrined in the nuclear posture of the United States that the goal of U.S. nuclear policy is to eliminate nuclear weapons. I think that's the direction we're going in. That's where the consensus is leading us. I think we're picking up speed on this. We're actually making more progress on this than we have been in recent years. And it's thanks to the leadership, a lot of which is right here in the San Francisco Bay Area, that we're making the kind of progress that we have been. And we can hope for a more secure and peaceful and decidedly less nuclear world in the decade ahead.
Unfortunately, we're out of time. On behalf of the World Affairs Council of Northern California, I will thank Joseph Cerencioni for his insightful comments and also thank the audience for your questions.
Thank you. Real pleasure being here. Thank you very much.